Welcome to Book Spectrum. I'm Chris Cordeni, your host. This is where we introduce you to books by authors, some of them seasoned, but many of them first time or out of other professions across the spectrum. Hey, see what I did there? Chris Cordeni, the host, once again. In this edition, I'm going to introduce you to a gentleman who has put together some rather fascinating historical fiction. That's a lot of fun because it mixes reality with what-ifs and interesting stories and maybe some inspiration to research this gentleman on your own. George Washington and other founding fathers are buried into the archives of history. Every kid in America knows who they are. Heck, they even know about Benedict Arnold, one of the more famous traitors. However, how about a traitor that maybe went along to our side? Somebody that helped us out. The revolutionaries. We're going to talk about one of those gentlemen right now. We're going to talk about a gentleman named Thomas Machen. He's a Brit who deserted that side, wound up helping us not only in the war effort, but with a lot of other things, including some work around Cape Cod. There's a very interesting story about him called Chains Across the River, and that's written by a history man himself, Beavis Longstreth, and he's with me now. Welcome to Book Spectrum, Beavis.
Delighted to be here.
I'm glad you're here. You're a history guy. What fascinates you about looking back at the birth of America? Besides, of course, the actual birth of America.
Well, I mean, you can't be an American without being interested in our origins. And the more you read about it, the more you realize how close a call it seemed to be. The British had been smarter. They might have won that war, although over time they probably would have lost even if they won the war at the time. Anyway, it's a fascinating era, and I happen to have a house in Garrison, New York on the Hudson River, and so thinking about the chains that Thomas Machen constructed and put across the river, two separate trains at separate times. It's very tempting because I'm so close to it all. And the museums that I researched in are all around, sprinkled around the Hudson River.
Let's talk about this, Beavis, because you and I do have that in common. We're both Hudson Valley guys. I'm just at a different side of the river.
Yeah, well, we're on the east side. You're on the west, is that right?
Control of the Hudson River was very important during the Revolution. George Washington, yes. General Washington knew it. His top officers knew it. Spies knew it. And the Brits knew it. Thomas Machen was very instrumental in helping the effort here. So let's talk about that. And that's what's fascinating, not only with the history of the Revolution, but the local history involved.
Right, exactly. And, I mean, you just can't look at the river without getting pretty excited about the concept of hanging a chain, stringing a chain across the river, 1,500 feet of heavy chain to stop a warship under 850 tons they weighed, under full sail with the tide with them. That has to be a big chain. And then to support the chain, you support it with logs, log rafts, trees 2 feet in diameter. And they had to be trees that would support the chain. So it had to be white pine or other kind of pine.
Hence the title of the book, Chains Across the River, Beavis. What kind of research did you put in for the creation of the book? And I'm not talking about just the factual part, but the historical fiction end.
Well, I put a lot of research. I started out at the public library in New York, and I migrated to the Historical Society on Central Park West. And then I found it possible to and desirable to visit the Putnam History Museum in Cold Spring, the West Point Museum, the Sterling Forest State Park Museum, and the one at Washington's headquarters, and finally at Fort Montgomery, there's a museum, a terrific little museum, which is sharply focused on what happened there, and therefore very useful to me, because what happened there is the first chain was installed, and it was cut by the British from the land.
They got one, but they didn't get everything. That's important.
No, they didn't. Well, they never tested the second chain, which was put up at, between West Point and Constitution Island. It was a heavier chain, almost twice as heavy. If you took weighed all the links, it would be 65 tons of forged iron. But it was never tested, and that I think is the best explanation for why this story isn't well known, because nothing happened. Things happened in Trenton, and they happened in Princeton, and in the Delaware, and elsewhere. There were battles. There were, but the chain that was constructed, and the second chain between West Point and Constitution Island, was never tested, and therefore it's not of great interest, except to people like me, I guess, because
We're nerds. We like this stuff. There were some chains and some obstructions just to keep control of the Hudson River. And with me, of course, is Beavis Longstreth, who wrote a historical fiction book called Chains Across the River concerning this particular part of American history and the Revolutionary War history. Our founding fathers did not have GE to poison the Hudson River with PCBs against the British at the time, so we had to put chains up, right?
Well, their guns could shoot at ships sailing up the river, but the guns were not very effective, and the chain was considered by Washington as absolutely. He said it was controlling the river was, quote, of infinite importance, close quote. And after the first chain was cut, he immediately demanded that Macon put up another chain, and which was done in 3 months' time by the ironworks at Sterling Lake. Just an incredible accomplishment. You think about the trees without. There are no chainsaws. In fact, there is no electricity.
Here's another question, and you've done the research on this, so I'm going to ask, before we divert to the fiction portion, on the fact part, How did George Washington, General Washington, know to trust Mackin, even though he was a British deserter? Maybe he could have been a plant, or maybe he could have been somebody who was still loyal as a Tory, or maybe just some kind of tattletale, or maybe a double turncoat. Who knows? I think I've pretty much run the gamut. What made George Washington trust Mackin, considering all of that?
Well, it's a mystery. I mean, I think that's part of the magic of Washington is that he really was an incredibly good judge of people. There were exceptions, I think, in his history, but in this case, he really struck gold, and. It's exactly what you say. It's so surprising because this guy was a deserter. So he came to Cambridge from being stationed in Boston, and having deserted and gotten into a canoe and paddled up to Cambridge, and put himself in the hands of the George Washington and his men, including, importantly, Henry Knox, who was the general in charge of artillery. But there was no artillery at that time, but he was the general. And somehow, in a short space of time, after deserting in 1775, I think it was in July. By July of 76, Washington was ordering him in a letter to go to Fort Montgomery and to put yourself under the command of Colonel James Clinton and act as the engineer to complete such works as are already laid out and such as others as you, with the advice of Colonel Clinton, may think necessary. But the point was that what necessary for what? For to stop the British Armada, 200 ships assembling in New York Harbor. I mean, it was audacious and remarkable. And he picked a man who had enormous perseverance, energy, and skill in engineering. It was a, I mean, you could say it was a lucky strike. I mean, just but I think there was some judgment involved in it, obviously, and it worked.
Beavis Longstreth is with me on Book Spectrum. His book, Chains Across the River. Let's get to the fiction part. The story, as you said, of Chains Across the River, the real one, was not as exciting because the action wasn't there. So let's talk about where your book and history kind of diverge a little bit. The what-ifs and the excitement that you bring to the table with what could have happened.
Yeah, well, that's important. I have, though there's no evidence of it, it's plausible to me, and therefore it's part of my book, even though it may be mostly fiction. I have Macon joining Henry Knox in his amazing, and this is history, his amazing trip to Ticonderoga to get some guns to give him, as general of the artillery, a reality of actually having artillery. And the Ticonderoga had been captured by actually none other than Benedict Arnold and Ethan Allen in the summer of 1775. And so in the winter of 76, in January, Knox went to Ticonderoga to get the guns that the British had left there. And he brought them 300 miles across the snow and ice to Cambridge. And I have Macon, importantly, serving with Henry Knox in that trip. That's one of the fictions. Another fiction is the love life that I give to Macon.
The romantic story.
The romantic story. I mean, it's not excessive, and it doesn't dominate the book in any way, but it just adds some reality, really, because men have love lives, and he must have had one, although there's no record of it. So I created a record. It involved an unusual woman who actually is real. Her name is Lisa Van Horn, and she came from a large family in New Jersey, living in a house called Convivial Hall. And this is all true. There is a Convivial Hall, and the family really played both sides against the middle. They were really, it was an entertainment place for Brits as well as Americans. And so it, that much is true. And so it becomes a focal point in the book, a place where things can happen. Information can be exchanged between the sides.
Beavis, when it comes to historical fiction, and this is where it gets really fascinating, whether you're a history buff or not, you still know most of these characters, or at least the really famous ones, like your George Washingtons, your Knoxes and Clintons of the world. You can't make up their characters and their backstories. They're already ingrained in their lives when you're putting together a fiction novel involving them. Talk about the difference between doing that and creating your own characters and putting together a regular fiction novel.
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting question. When it comes to people of great fame, and they've been covered so frequently by historians who've written histories of them, biographies, where every detail of fact is so important, and if you don't get it right, you get criticized. That's something I haven't chosen to do. And so the four novels I've written all are historical novels, to be sure, but they are novels about things that are not well known, not well covered, not well researched, for which biographies don't exist. And therefore, they provide opportunity for the fictional side of the story. And that gives you really some scope to play around and to use your imagination. And I like doing that. So I haven't chosen to write biographies. There is one, I guess I can only think of one story. No, actually, there are more than one. But Gore Vidal wrote a fictional account of Lincoln, which is very good, well worth reading. But it's fiction. But normally, somebody about books about Lincoln are not fictional, and they're biographies. So anyway, that's the difference, and that's why I enjoy doing books on remote historical events where I have some scope to imagine. The first one I did was on the oldest pile rug in the world. It hangs in the Hermitage in St. Petersburg, and it's dated to 400 BC. So there weren't a lot of biographies of people being written about in those days. So I had a lot of freedom to imagine in that book about the woman who wove it, who wove that great piece of tapestry.
With me is Beavis Longstreth. He is the author of Chains Across the River, a history meister, if you will. This isn't your only historical fiction book. You've done this quite a few times beforehand, haven't you?
Yes, there are four novels, four historical novels. And I was just describing the first one. It's called Spindle and Bow, and it's about the ancient rug.
That's the next thing. The carefulness you have to put into the characters, because a lot of people know who some of the major players are, and they can point and say, wait a minute, that would never have happened, that sort of thing. You got to be careful of all of that, because you know, real history professors are probably reading these books thinking, well, let's see if I can pick this apart. I'm kind of half joking about that. But what attracted you to historical fiction rather than just writing your own books and saying, hey, let's just put this out there?
Well, I think it's the fact that I always wished I'd majored in history, but I didn't at college. I think that it's also a product of being a lapsed lawyer. My career was really as a government official for a brief time, but mainly as a practicing lawyer in New York City. And so I enjoy research. And so the research is fun for me. And I think I'm good at it. And so research combined with history gives you historical writing. And then if you add your imagination where it's called for, it becomes a historical novel instead of just history.
Do you have a sort of a, and I know it's kind of silly to ask, but I like to know these things. Do you have a sort of favorite historical period to write about or at least research? Maybe you haven't written about it yet.
No, I don't think I have any particular period that I prefer over another. I mean, I started with 400 BC in what's now Siberia, and I've ended up with the Hudson River, and in between, I covered the Dust Bowl period of the Great Depression and the WPA, particularly the theater project of the WPA. So I guess I like them all.
I noticed that you do like to employ the, let's say, I like to call it the Clean River era of the Hudson River, which is definitely considered by some ancient history, but that's a different story for a different day.
Yes.
Beavis, what do you want your listeners to get out of this book and learn from it? I understand it's fiction meant much of it, but this is also based on historical fact, and it does inspire someone. And this is the kind of thing that inspires someone to say, hey, Mackin, let's research him a little bit more. Who are these other players in history that were never taught to me in high school or even college in some respects?
Well, I'd like people to take away from this book the enormous accomplishment and the ambition and audacity of Washington and men like Macon to take on such an assignment and actually accomplish it. I think it compares the construction, the design, construction, and installation of these two chains, particularly the second, the bigger one, at West Point, compared to Grant's march to Vicksburg or even the construction of the pyramids. I think it compares to Hoover Dam, Brooklyn Bridge, or the transatlantic cable in its accomplishment. And nobody knows about it. So I think what I hope people will do is take away the same sense of awe that I have, which only increased as I did the research, about what they accomplished without chainsaws. You know, without outboard motors, they had to bring all the chain down from New Windsor to West Point with a tide changing every 6 hours. And they can't go against the tide with that kind of weight. So how do they do it? It's really amazing.
Beavis Longstreth, thank you very much for being with us on Book Spectrum. Once again, the book is Chains Across the River. I do want to ask, before we actually do close this out, in doing the research for this book, what was something that might have surprised you?
Well, I was surprised, first of all, it never occurred to me that they would support the chain with these huge log rafts. You say put a chain across the river, and I just imagine a chain. Until I started researching, I didn't know there was a raft supporting the chain. And then when you think about it, of course, if there weren't a raft to support the chain, to pull it across the river, it would probably sink low enough below the surface of the water in the middle to allow a boat to go across anyway. So that was surprising. There are a lot of endless surprises, really.
Beavis Longstreth, thank you very much once again for being here on Book Spectrum. Once again, you can find Beavis's book on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all sorts of digital outlets. You can also find a link to his book and his website on our page, bookspectrum.com. I'm Chris Cordani. Thank you for listening to Book Spectrum.